we'll talk about something that's hard for a lot of people, saying no. Research shows that turning people down can be so difficult that people will even agree to unethical requests just to avoid saying no.
Elizabeth Bernstein wrote about saying no in her latest column. She writes the Bonds column for the Wall Street Journal. Elizabeth, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Why is it so hard for people to say no?
Well, you, in a nutshell, we want to get along. We are pleasers, most of us, or at least we want people to like us. It's very important to be part of communities. So it's very hard then to feel like we're rejecting somebody when we say no to them.
And how does not saying no get us into trouble when it comes to our busy work and personal lives?
Well, we're all, as you say, so busy. We're almost overwhelmed. I mean, the kids, two jobs, you know, just everything, the pace of modern life with technology. And so we have requests coming at us from all areas, from our families, from our friends, from bosses, coworkers, and charities. It goes on and on. And so if we don't learn to say no, we'll get nothing done. We really have to protect what's important to us and what we most want to get done. To protect our priorities, we really have to learn to manage them. And doing that is saying no to the ones that are not that important to us.
And I think that the ones who are not that important to us tend to feel bad when we say no. At least that's what it seems like we're worried about, that when we say no to somebody, we're going to hurt their feelings and we're going to damage a relationship no matter what level that relationship is at. Is that true? How damaging is saying no?
Well, it is exactly that. That's what we're worried about, that we are going to hurt someone's feelings. We're going to let them down. You know, it's true, actually. Our brains react more strongly to negative information than they do to positive. So when someone hears a no, they do have a pretty strong reaction just in their brain. Neuroscience shows us that. But at the same time, there's something out there that researchers call the harshness bias. And what this is that we feel others will judge us more than they actually will. We're worried that the, you know, sort of the amount of hurt that we're going to give or the amount of criticism we're going to get is worse than it will actually be. So yes, people will be hurt when we say no, probably, but it won't be as bad. They won't be as devastated as we think they will be.
Well, and that gap is probably where the trouble comes from, the difference between how bad they'll really feel and how bad we expect they'll feel if we say no to whatever the request is.
Exactly. So in that gap is where all the problems happen.
So how do we get around that then? So we know we've got this gap. We know we'll be better off if we learn to say no. How do we take those first steps and start to get more comfortable with it?
Well, it's interesting. I talk to sort of therapists and other experts, psychologists on this, and they say that the number one thing you want to do is plan ahead. So you want to have sort of a no in your back pocket. You want to have a ready-to-use answer for requests of any kind, really, that you don't think you can do. So you want to have it. It should be polite. When you deliver it, it should be gentle. You don't want to just shout out, no, I would never do that. You know, so you want to sort of say, I'm sorry, but I cannot do that. But it also should be definitive, exactly that. You know, I cannot do that. So, you know, those are the big ones. Also, another interesting, important thing to do would be to learn not to say yes on the spot. So maybe you get blindsided, you're at work, coworker asks you, you know, hey, can you drive me home tomorrow, whatever it is, and you can't do it, you need to say, you know what, let me think about that. I'll get back to you. So you want to learn not to say yes just because you're put on the spot and you don't know what else to say.
One of our WPR colleagues has a running joke along these lines. If you ask him to do something, he'll say, no, I have anything else to do at that time. And I assume we need something a little more polite than that.
I have something else to do. There you go. It's just anything will do. I'm not doing what you want.
And in terms of the research on this, there is actual research about people being biased against saying no, isn't there? People will go to incredible lengths to say yes or to avoid saying no is more the point.
Exactly. People will go to incredible lengths to not have the uncomfortableness of saying no. So researchers do study this, and they also know that if we say a no one time, if we decline a request, we're more likely to say yes the next time, simply because of the guilt of saying no that first time. But researchers study saying no, and in one study that I liked, they asked people, they got a whole bunch of college students to go up to strangers with a library book. The college students had the library book. They asked these strangers to deface replace the library book by writing the word pickle in it in pen. And they had predicted the students, they'd asked the students, predict how many people do you think will do this? And the students said, oh, about 29% of people will do this. It turned out it was half the people said, oh, okay, you know, I don't feel comfortable doing this, but I'll do it. They'd rather write pickle in a library book than say no and hurt the feelings of a stranger.
Is there a certain personality type that has more trouble with this than others?
There are. You know, anybody who is a pleaser, who, you know, wants to please, there's people who are conflict adverse. They don't like to be in any kind of uncomfortable situation where there's an argument or a conflict. Those people, there are people who just habitually say yes to everything, sort of the so-called doormats who just, you know, never, ever step up and say no and protect themselves.
Is there any research on whether it's better, in terms of the reaction we have in our brains when we hear no, whether it's better to have someone just say a flat-out no or to have someone say yes but then you keep stringing the other person along, say an office mate who keeps wanting to clean out the office.
Just hypothetically.
And that office mate keeps canceling the cleanup date and week after week goes by and the office never gets cleaned out.
You know, I don't know of any particular research on that, but I did ask psychologists that, and they say that it is better to be upfront. And so where you get yourself into a problem is stringing the other person along.
Uh-huh.
Because now you have to basically, if you're saying yes and you really mean no, you're lying. Or, you know, you're just at the very best, you're putting off your decision to say no or the uncomfortableness of saying no. And so you're stringing it out, but you also are having to say it over and over. So it's better for both of you to say, look, I'm really sorry. I'm not going to be up for cleaning that office. I'm perfectly good with the mess as it is.
So the takeaway is that Rob is a liar.
Hey, whoa. We can get into this off air.
Okay.
Operation Cleansing Flame will be a reality at some point in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in our society, Elizabeth, we're often confronted with people who won't take no for an answer, whether it's a friend, a boss, somebody soliciting money on the phone, who their job in some ways is to break down that initial no, or a salesperson. How hard does that make it? How can we inure ourselves to that?
It makes it so much harder. So, yes, a lot of people, it is their job and they are trained well to make sure that they do not take no for an answer. So, moms are among that group, by the way, too. What you need to do is stand firm, and that makes it even harder. So, you said no one time, and now you have to say it a bunch more, but you need to learn to do that. So again, the experts will say you stay polite and you say, no, I'm sorry, I can't do that. And no matter how many times that person says, but are you sure you don't really want to buy, you know, these bonds I'm selling, then you keep saying, no, I'm sorry, I don't want to do that. You just have to keep repeating the same thing over and over.
So the same thing over and over, is it important to just use that pattern, something that diffuses or defangs the other person quicker?
Well, because you want to get rid of them, right? You don't want them to keep coming back at you. So you don't want to say, you don't want to put them off. Well, you know, call me next week. But you don't, if you keep varying your excuses, they might be seeing a hole in there. Well, this excuse was this today, and yesterday it was something else. You know, so you just want to, you don't even owe an excuse in many cases. You do if it's someone you're close to or a family member. You know, grandma, I can't come over this weekend. I'm really sorry. You know, the kids are sick. It has to be something specific if you're close to them, but you do not owe failed salespeople an answer on why. You don't owe them an explanation, just no, and you keep repeating it.
In our lives, though, there will be times when it'll be better off for everyone if we say yes. Assuming we take the time after that initial request, don't immediately say yes, how do we start doing that mental triage that, yeah, this is something I can prioritize and know that other thing isn't?
Meaning, when you say yes, but you really wanted to say no.
Or no, how do we figure out when we don't give that initial yes answer? How do we sit back, take a step away, and then make that decision? Yeah, this is something I ought to do.
Well, so that's why, again, you don't want to give an answer right away. So you say, let me sit on that, let me sleep on that, and then you think about it, and you're right. There are times, many times really, especially with family or your boss, that you're better off saying yes, even if it's something you didn't want to do or squeezing it in. And so then you really have to think, like, you know, I'm not the only person here that has to be happy with this decision. Will the most amount of people be happier? Will it benefit my family? Will it benefit my job? You know, you want to ask yourself these questions, like what's the upside of doing this? And you may find out that it's not that hard to see that it's something you should do.
We're talking to Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein about how to say no more effectively.
And what about you? Do you have a hard time saying no? Have you ever agreed to something you didn't want to do just because it was easier than saying no? And what strategies do you have? You can call in and share your experiences at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. And you can also send us email to talk@WPR.org. We're picking up our conversation about the difficulty lots of us have saying no and how to overcome it with Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein. She tweets at EBernsteinWSJ.
And you can join the conversation. Do you have trouble saying no? Are you too busy, constantly overwhelmed because you say yes whenever you're asked to do this or that at work or away from work? Or have you learned how to say no? What's been the benefit of that? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
And Elizabeth, we talked about some of the techniques we can use to learn to say no. One of them is repeating the same words over and over again, or giving yourself space to think about it and maybe building up to that no. What about tone of voice? Does that matter?
It does matter. Being a gentle, sort of calm tone of voice, what happens is I think some of us feel that we just get pushed too far. We're spread thin to begin with. Then someone's coming at us with a request, and we, try to say no, but we really waffle out of it. And, you know, by the time we really decide we need to say no, we're just shouting it out or, you know, snapping and saying, no, I can't. So you want to be gentle and polite, very polite, and just say, look, I wish I could, but I cannot. I am sorry. So, tone does matter a lot.
And how about hedging? Like, well, not this time, but maybe next year, or maybe sometime, but not now.
Well, by doing that, they've got you. So maybe next year, they're coming right back at you next year. So probably charities love this because they just put you right on their list for next year. So, you know, no should be no unless you want them to come back next year. Maybe, you know, you just this year you're done with these requests, but next year you have time. But if you don't want them to come back, forget it. It's like telling a telemarketer, yeah, call me next week. No, you don't want to hear from them next week, so...
Do you have any stories about people who did harness the power of saying no and how it changed their lives?
I did. I have stories of people who learned how they sort of taught themselves how to say no. One woman was, she said she's very petite and sort of had a gentle voice, but she was also a pretty big executive, and people would not really take no, especially she was always asked to sit on charity boards, and they wouldn't necessarily take no for an answer. She felt they didn't take her seriously when she tried to push back. She was spread thin. She was on too many boards. So she said she would stand on her office chair. She would get up on her office chair to make herself feel stronger and taller and bigger, and she would sort of growl no at them. So it did backfire once when her boss walked in, but other than that, I think it worked out okay for her. She even told me her tips on balancing on the swivel chair. She
wow.
said, you put one knee on the desk.
Don't try this at home. Well, Elizabeth, I know people and you have readers, and often when you write things like this, it touches a nerve with a lot of people. Is this one of those? Do you keep hearing from people who say, oh my God, this is my life?
Yeah, I do. People say, wow, like, that's me. You know, not everybody. Of course, there are people who have no trouble at all saying no. It's just their knee-jerk reaction to almost anything. But, most people, a lot of people wrote me and said, you know, this is me. Thank you. I hate letting people down. Or, you know, and what's interesting, too, is there's not research that shows whether men and women are different. But the experts who study it say, anecdotally, they believe that women have a harder time saying no, and that's because women are they're conditioned to be the connectors in society and in their families. They're the ones that have to keep all the relationships going, and so they're really juggling so many more balls in the air, so it's hard to let people down. But men are conditioned to, you know, provide for their families. And so with that goal in mind, and it's very easy for them to say, well, no, this doesn't fit into that goal, so of course I wouldn't do that.
Let's go to the phones right now. We have Marcus with us from Green Bay. Hi, Marcus.
Hello. I recently volunteered to give an older gentleman a ride home from the food pantry with his groceries. One thing led to another, and I was bringing him for rides all over the place. And one day he called me. I was shoveling snow, and I carefully explained to him that I couldn't do it. He wouldn't take no for an answer, and this went on and on and on until finally I wouldn't answer the phone, and there were messages, tons of messages. And finally he sent over the police because he was supposedly concerned. They told me to block the phone, that they know this gentleman. And now I find out he's slandering my name up and down this strip of businesses where I live, blaming me for all his woes. So, what, you know, I have a note in my wallet with three sentences explaining that I'm not responsible for him or his personal problems. Mm-hmm. How should I feel about this? I do feel a bit of anger and yet sympathy for
gotcha.
The person.
So, Marcus, I want to get Elizabeth in on this. Unfortunate, you know, a good deed done there, but taken advantage of, I guess, and an expectation that he'd keep doing things for a person.
Exactly. This person had an expectation. It's very hard. I can appreciate how you feel, because you probably feel guilty as well. Like, you know, you're somebody who needs help, and you know, but I can't step up all the time. But you're right. Your note in your wallet is correct. You're not responsible for someone else. You did a good deed. If you want to do a good deed again, that's great. Hopefully it will not escalate in the future with someone else. But also, my guess is someone that is that, I mean, I shouldn't say anything bad, but my guess is someone that latches on to you, a stranger, and will not let go, probably has some other problems too, thinking correctly. And so this is not even somebody who sort of has an ability to lead his life pretty well, I'm guessing. So you should all know this person doesn't probably think correctly. It's not my fault. It's not my responsibility to take care of it. And don't let that stop you, though, from trying to do more good deeds.
And we have a caller who couldn't stay on the line who asks, how can a business communicate a change of policy to customers who might not like the new change without losing the customer? So for businesses who, you know, that the old credo, the customer is always right, how do they handle that?
I think you would want to explain it certainly very carefully why you're doing this, why you have to change whatever the thing is you're changing. But also, if people are upset, listen to them. Listen to them carefully and say, I'm upset. Don't just keep telling them, oh, well, this is good for you, if they feel that it's not. Say, I'm really sorry. I really hear you, but unfortunately, this is the change we had to make. I think sometimes when people feel heard, that's enough. You know, they don't need you to do what they want as long as they do feel you at least heard them.
We also had a note from Reed in Clintonville who says, when I get a telemarketer on the phone, I engage that person in conversation and ask lots of questions about themselves, where they're from, because they don't want to talk about themselves. They want to make a sale. They get off the phone pretty quickly. So I guess divert and change the subject a little bit to say no.
Totally. Yeah, change all the rules on them. But the problem is, what if you get a chatty one? You'll be on there forever. But that's a good strategy. Might want to try it.
Did you meet anyone who is a super no-sayer and just really went to town with it and employed it all the time? I'm just curious about, you know, whether in general people do say no or say yes too often, and if they really just, you know, the opposite of saying yes all the time, if they say no all the time, they're happier.
I think people who say no all the time, well, I don't know if they're happier. I haven't met somebody, as you said, but I've witnessed it. I've seen people who are very good at this. And I don't know if they're happier, but I do imagine that they have more time for their own priorities and their own things they want to do. So perhaps they really are happier. The only drawback would be, you know, are they making the connections they need to make and sustaining them? If they're making people mad, you know, then they're, you know, they may not be happier, but maybe they're saying no effectively and politely, and then going off and doing things that they like to do.
How are you at saying no, Elizabeth? We're glad you say yes when people ask you to come on Midwestern public radio programs. Keep doing that. But apart
you.
From important things like that, how are you on this whole yes-no thing?
I am not so good, depending on who it is. So if it's a family member, if it's my mom, if it's a good friend, like it's hard for me to say no then. But, you know, so I'm learning. That's one reason I needed to write the article.
Are there different cultures that are better at saying no? I wonder sometimes if it's a peculiar American thing that we really want to keep saying yes.
You know, I don't know about the research about that, but I would guess that Americans are, you know, have a good day. They're known, you know, sort of around the world for being people who have sort of almost what reads to other cultures as almost like a fake politeness. And so, you know, maybe somewhere in there we say, you know, yes a lot. So I don't really know the answer, but my guess is Americans could use some lessons in saying no.
And I wonder about, you know, habits of highly effective people and success in the business world and that sort of thing. If there's a rivalry in schools of thought between, yeah, say yes, get involved, get things done, you'll impress people, versus no, don't take on too much, focus on what you're doing and do it well.
I think it is. It's a balance that you have to strike. So, because if you're saying yes across the board, I mean, this is also the work-family balance. If you're saying, you know, yes to everything, you're not going to be able to prioritize and move forward on the things that are important. So you can't just say yes to everything across your company because your own boss is going to be upset. You know, why aren't you doing, you know, what my department needs you to do? So it's probably a balance that you really have to work at continuously.
And you talked about women, but if you look at, you know, for instance, Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In campaign, which involves saying yes an awful lot and then some, maybe to get things done, it's just the wrong way to go, leaning in. I don't know. Have you thought about leaning in and saying no?
Well, I know some of the criticism for leaning in, which, you know, so many people, you know, think is so interesting and good. But I have heard some of the criticism is that, you know, it's nice if you have a big support network. So you can say yes to everything if you've got a staff to help you, nannies and housekeepers and all of these things. But if it's just you, you know, raising your kids, going to work, keeping your family going, and all the other things, you know, wanting to give some money to charity, say, but you can't give it all away. So you do, no matter what, even if you do lean in, you still need to prioritize.
Elizabeth, thanks for joining us. Will you come on again sometime?
Yes, thank you.
Yes, yay.
Good answer.
That was Elizabeth Bernstein, columnist for The Wall Street Journal. We've got a link to her article on saying no on our Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Vera.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Max Garland, Wisconsin's poet laureate, has a long history with the state's rural landscape. In an essay for the Reedsburg Fermentation Festival newsletter, he says Wisconsin's farmlands and natural areas can be a source of wonder and even of artistic inspiration.
We'd love to hear from you on this. Do you stop and gaze at the rolling farmlands and pastures in Wisconsin, and do you feel a sense of wonder and inspiration out in the country? Do you have a favorite view? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
Poet laureate Max Garland joins us now from our studio in Eau Claire. His piece, Cultivating Wonder, is posted on the Fermentation Festival website. Max, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Well, nice to be here.
You write that you were re-inspired while bicycling on the loop around Reedsburg last year, I guess, during the Fermentation Fest. What did you see that got you thinking?
Well, it was hard not to be taken aback or impressed. Let's see, what did I see? I saw an operatic soprano singing on the hillside with a dress made out of corn stalks and being accompanied by a piano. I saw a 6600 John Deere that had the metal panels taken out and replaced with stained glass. I saw a hillside in which there were dozens and dozens of kites shaped and spotted like Holsteins. And so all in all, it was a pretty remarkable, and that's not mentioning how beautiful the landscape from Reedsburg to Lime Rock and Ironton actually is on its own, but this idea of putting art out in the already beautiful landscape, that's what sort of triggered my thinking about this sort of idea of cultivating wonder.
And this isn't anything new. You wrote the piece near the Man Mound in Reedsburg. Humans have a long history of combining art and Wisconsin's outdoors.
Right. I mean, at first one might think, well, this is an unusual thing. There's art in the countryside, and this festival every October is something that, you know, might be interesting to drive or stop and look at. However, the point I try to make in the essay is that people have, in the rural areas of Wisconsin, have been making art as long as they've been here. Our great grandmothers, our great great grandmothers spent those long winter nights making quilts that weren't just useful, but they were beautiful. Even before in the early days of the European settling, it was hard work in those lumber camps, but every one of them had a fiddler. So there was an understanding that art and beauty and wonder were necessary, even when the bare necessities were barely taken care of. But finally, the point I make is that for thousands of years, drums, chants, stories, songs, poems, and all of this sort of exemplified for one of the most amazing works of art, rural art, which is a 214-foot human-shaped effigy mound just outside of Baraboo that's about 1,000 years old. And that to me was this idea of fashioning something that's amazing and that is a work of art into the countryside, even into the land itself, goes back further than we really have memory of. And the day that I sat there by the man mound, this huge effigy mound, and wrote the essay, it was covered with thousands and thousands of violets, which coincidentally is Wisconsin's state flower.
Now, when you are out there looking at the landscape, maybe getting your own inspiration, do you feel like you're communing with the people who built that mound and the people who made those quilts?
I can't even, I can't presume to know what the people, we don't even know for sure. Probably the late woodland people, maybe 1,000 years ago, but there's so much that we don't know. But even an amateur such as myself, I can commune in this way. Here is a human shape. It might be a spirit. It might be a divine figure. And it's made out of earth. And every ounce of earth, every handful of earth in it is made out of living organisms. And so am I. And so at least, I'm not going to pretend to be an anthropologist or archaeologist, but I can figure that much out.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. We've got Ariel in Delafield. Ariel, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I love Wisconsin. I am inspired daily by just the beautiful scenery that I see while bicycling around or driving around in my area, which is the Southern Tenebrain State Forest.
And what is it? How does it inspire you? How does it make you feel?
It just makes me feel happy. I see cranes in the fields or fawns when I pull into my subdivision, or just the sunbeams shooting through the twilight sun as it goes through the white pines. Like, it's just gorgeous, and it makes me feel peaceful and calm and just full of beauty. And I think that when people take the moment to look at that sun ray as it goes through the trees or feel the cool air as you go into the forest further. Like, when you take those moments of reflection, of calmness, of really a spiritual cleansing, that's really what's happening to you. And I think that helps you be just better, happier.
Ariel, thank you so much for that call. Max, I don't know if Ariel is a poet, but her description of the landscape came out kind of poetical. Does it kind of naturally flow?
It really did. Two or three things are interesting about that. One is what she mentioned, the cranes, the deer, the white pines, all of these things that we really identify with Wisconsin, were preserved at some point. They were almost completely eliminated. The town where I am right now, is the reason that it's here in the way it is because of white pines, and they were almost all cut down in an amazingly short time. But people stopped from the brink. They realized what she realized, to some extent in the nick of time. And now we understand that we work and we are a part of that. We have to manage it. We have to be – if we want it to continue, we have to pass it on if we want it to keep coming. And what she's – another thing she talked about stopping.
Yeah.
We all recognize that when we fly across the country or we fly to another country, we become disoriented. We don't know where we are. We can't eat right. We can't sleep right. We're not experiencing things, and we call that jet lag. It's my contention that every time you drive across the state, which I've driven 17,000 to 18,000 miles across it in the last year and a half, you have a sort of mini jet lag. You have to wait until you slow down enough to figure out where you are, and you can see and hear and feel and smell and really get back onto human time. And I rode my bike here, and I was watching hundreds and hundreds of cars at what, you know, what we call rush hour here in Eau Claire. And I was thinking, we're in the state so often. And when we're in the state, what we don't realize is that the land itself is actually moving. Once we stop and look at the shape of the hills and the shape of the river and the streams, we realize that, oh, it's moving too. It's not a static thing. It's not inert. And once we realize, you know, pick up a handful of dirt and we realize, oh, and this is not inert. This is full of more living organisms than there are people on Earth. And once you take that time and you're slowing down, then suddenly the idea of the wonder of where you are and what your relationship to that place is begins to sort of kick in.
Do we take it for granted, this treasure we have?
Yes, we take it for granted because we are bombarded by sales pitch and propaganda and all sorts of things that cause us to want to hustle and move from place to place. We think the greatest sin is not being busy. And once you do slow down and you think, oh, yes, this land is moving. It always was. Oh, this land is not dead. It's full of living organisms. I'm holding in my hand billions of them. And then you realize that the hand itself of 27 bones also contains many living organisms, microbes, bacteria. And so that relationship to that place really takes you back to what I think might have been one of the messages of the people who, over the course of months, if not years, built the Man Mound, which is, this is our home. We are made of this.
We're talking to Wisconsin poet laureate Max Garland about Wisconsin's rural and natural landscapes. He says they're an amazing source of inspiration and wonder.
And we'd love to hear from you. Do you agree with this? Does this resonate with you? Call 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite view in Wisconsin? Do you just love walking, driving, soaking in the farmland? Have you been inspired creatively by those landscapes? Call 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email talk@WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation after the news. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation with State Poet Laureate Max Garland. We're talking about his recent essay on Wisconsin's rural landscapes. He says they're a source of wonder and artistic inspiration.
And you can join the conversation with a call at 800-642-1234. Do you find yourself inspired or entranced by Wisconsin's landscapes, or do you find yourself wishing you made more time to just stop and observe, watch, look, listen? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Max, before we get back to our callers, we've been talking a lot about the visual. You also write a little bit about the soundscape of the places you're talking about. What do you listen for there?
It takes a while if you're traveling across the interstate and to get that roar out of your, you know, the vibration and the roar out of your ears to start hearing and differentiating between the things that you're hearing. I was leading a group of students a few years ago and we were just doing an orientation and I was pointing out, well, that's a white pine, that's a tamarack, that's an elm tree, it's probably doomed, that's a crow, and I was doing these things, and this girl said she thought she had made a mistake. I thought I signed up for an English class, and here I was, you know, telling her what the sounds of these birds were and all that. And she said, how do you know all this? And I said, well, I live here. I mean, it seemed like the kind of thing that you should know if you live in a place, what things sound like, the names of things, the differences between trees. For many, many thousands of years, it's been necessary to know that in order to survive. And even though we may think it's not necessary, there is still something about understanding who we are. and our relationship to the world in which we live that I think still makes it necessary to pay attention to the place we live and the parts of that, the sounds, the sights, the smells, the shape of the land.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Kurt on the line in Wauwatosa. Kurt, hi.
How you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I just chimed into this program on my way home from work here, and I felt compelled to call right away. One of the things that really inspires me about Wisconsin is the ancient landscape that is so readily overlooked by many people that are not aware of the ancient landscape that's going around us, and in particular the Epagee Mound landscape of Wisconsin. It's been a source of inspiration for me since I was a small boy, and it's one of the main reasons why I head out and spend time in the especially a lot of the rural areas of Wisconsin. I am an archaeologist by trade, and one of the things that is really unique about Wisconsin is this ancient Epagee Mound culture that we have, and there are literally thousands of ancient Indian mounds all over the state that that are being protected by various groups of people and inspired people even 1,000 years later.
Kurt, thank you so much for sharing that. We talked about one of the mounds, Max, but I like the way you put it, part of our ancient landscape that we still walk among here in Wisconsin.
I think that's true. And whenever we talk about the heritage of art, we have to remember that it's been going on here for thousands of years, 10 to 12,000 years. This the confluence of the rivers where I am right now, people taught other people how to make things and how to do things and how to sing things and how to remember things. And it's a long tradition, and it's still a part of our tradition as well.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Nathan with us in Platteville. Nathan, hi.
Hi. One of the things that I always thought was amazing about Wisconsin was there's like two different types of land here. And I grew up in Platteville and Dodgeville, and just seeing the rolling hills all my life. And then when I got married, I went on a honeymoon to Minocqua. And just being surrounded by the forest and seeing the lake, it's like you have two different universes in one state. And you get to see the gorgeous rolling hills where you can see it like as far into the horizon, and then you're up in the northern part where you're just surrounded by woods and you can feel nature's closer. And it's just traveling between those two really reminds you of the great difference Wisconsin holds and why it's such one of our greatest states.
Nathan, thank you so much. I'll see your hills and forests and raise you some bluffs and a winding Wisconsin River, too. There's so much diversity, Max.
And how about those dolomite cliffs on the southeast side of Door County with the caves and all of those things that have been carved away at for the last few million years, and the driftless area south of here where all of these – the amazingly sinuous Kickapoo River. You can't believe how many times it turns. And so there's a lot of that.
Thanks a lot, Nathan, for sharing that. We'll go now to Willem in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I totally agree with what he says about the beauty of the land and just noticing all the different birds and the trees and the quality of living in this beautiful environment. I live in eastern Dunn County, close to western Chippewa County, but things are changing very quickly with industrial frac sand mining, and I don't think that, like, it worries me that what happened with all the white pines were clear cut, but those things grow back, but hills don't grow back, and our peace and quiet don't grow back, and it's close to where I live, and I'm not a person that objects to this because this is close to where I live. I didn't like it when it started over by Hoffman Hills, but now they're proposing a 2,000-acre mine in western Chippewa County. People should look at the Chippewa County website and see how big this mining industry has exploded in western Chippewa County, a beautiful part of the state. The rolling hills everyone's speaking of, those are being carted off.
Well, and thanks a lot for the call. Max, so you're in Eau Claire. This is going on in your neck of the woods. Is this a concern for you when you think about the future of the landscapes we talk about?
Well, I am glad that someone left the hills for us. I am glad that the river, though it's had its trials, still flows through here. And the point, I think, of what I was saying, slowing down, looking around you, recognizing what's around you, it gives you a sense of wonder. And that word is connected with awe, astonishment, amazement. And the upshot of that sense of wonder is that you want to preserve it. You want to pass it on. You don't want to take it and use it up. The river that I'm just talking about that I crossed a few minutes ago and I'm going to cross a few more minutes, it still has a lesson for us, as those hills do, as that mound does. And the lesson that river has for us is, if you want to keep it coming, you have to pass it on. And that has to do with art, tradition, wisdom, education, and certainly has to do with the beauty of a place, because the beauty is part of the value of the place. It's part of what makes our life worth living.
Go back to our callers now with Paul in Laval. Paul, hi.
Hi, how's it going? I actually live right on the route of the Farmark Detour where you're taking your bicycle ride. Yeah, so you passed our little 10-acre farmette, and one thing I kind of noticed, I grew up in Southern Illinois, and I lived 25 years in Chicago. I think a lot of local people take for granted how beautiful this area really is and how lucky we are to be here. I mean, I've traveled extensively. I've been to Europe a number of times, you know, been around the Midwest, and there's no other place I'd rather live than where I live right here in Sauk County. And just wanted to kind of say that.
Paul, thank you so much for sharing that. And Max, can you leave us with some, I guess, art appreciation tips for enjoying the landscape that Paul was talking about?
Well, I think the last thing I would just say is that how art fits into this, whether it's something like the Fermentation Fest that's coming up October 4th, whether it's any other of the exercises of art in the rural community, is that art reminds us of that connection. It reminds us of who we are and where we come from and what's at stake. And once you see that beauty, once you experience that beauty and feel the beauty that people have been talking about, then in the words of the great American poet William Stafford, who said, "I place my feet carefully in such a world." I think that's what we want to do.
Max, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Max Garland, Wisconsin's poet laureate. His essay on Wisconsin's rural landscapes is called Cultivating Wonder. It appeared in the Fermentation Festival newsletter, and it's on their website. And the Reedsburg Fermentation Fest, as he mentioned, takes place from October 4th through 13th.